Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pediatric Anesthesia Podcast. I'm Mike Mulick, and this is mainly for my fellows. I'm just decided to play around a little bit with the idea of podcasting, and I'm trying to get some good information out to more people. And this is all based on my opinions. I'm not a board examiner. I did just recently, literally just got off the phone with a friend of mine who is a board examiner. And a huge portion of my senior faculty at Yale were all examiners. So over the last few years, I've just noticed a lot of trends, a lot of questions that I've seen with my fellows in helping them get ready for their oral boards. And so I just wanted to put together a collection of my ideas about oral boards. And I was thinking, why a podcast? Well, the reason is that you guys as fellows, you have very little time, and you're very busy with the fellowship and studying. So I wanted to give something that you could listen to at any time or anywhere, whenever the mood strikes. And I hope that you find it useful. Please give me some feedback, good or bad, and let me know if you want me to do more of these. So that's the intro for the podcast. And so here we go. This is the Oral Boards podcast. So I just mentioned that I got off the phone with my friend who's an examiner. I just wanted to make sure I was totally up to date with my information because it's been a few years since I did my exam. And it's still 2 35-minute sessions. The first one is the long stem, and you get a fairly long chunk of time. They don't really advertise it, but generally they're trying to check people in, and you get about maybe 10 minutes. Now, you don't want to count on that, but it tends to happen that way where you get a little bit longer than 5 minutes. And again, that's just kind of checking everybody in and making sure all the examiners are all set. I think when I did it, it was even longer. But anyway, so that starts the long stem. Then, and that of course is the one where you do the pre-op, the intra-op, and then the grab bags. So, and then each test is divided into three sections. So it goes 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then 10 minutes. So the first room I just mentioned. The second room is your short stem, where you jump right into the intra-op. Then you do the post-op, and then you have your grab bags. So that I should just point out. Listen to what I just said. 15 minutes are in the post-op section. That's a long time to have a lot of post-op. I kind of feel like a lot of people don't prepare enough for post-op problems. So, and then the other thing is that they say that you're supposed to get 5 minutes to prepare for that second room. That does not happen. You get ushered out of the first room, and you kind of have to immediately sort of collect your thoughts and then just dismiss anything bad that might have happened in that room, and you immediately have to go to the next room and you get started. And I think that by the time you sit down and you start reading the next stem, you probably have less than maybe 4 minutes. At least that's what happened in my case. There's two examiners, and then now they have this new thing where they have like an inconspicuous little camera somewhere. I don't think you guys will be able to see it, but it's basically where the senior examiner can watch remotely. So you'll just have two people at a desk. And the way in which you're graded is the same as it's been for, quite a while now. It's sound judgment and decision making, management of surgical and anesthetic complications. So the key word there is complications. Things are going to go wrong. Your appropriate application of scientific principles to clinical problems. Again, there's going to be problems. Adaptability to unexpected changes, that's an important one. And logical organization and effective presentation of the information. So based on what I have learned over the last few years and I took a Michael Ho course and I spent a lot of time with my faculty at Yale, and then just study kind of just talking with my friend who's an examiner, and I was just going over all the reasons that people fail. Generally, it's not because of a lack of knowledge. You know, the ABA has already determined that your knowledge is good by having taken the written test. So it's usually the failure to recognize that things are changing and a failure to adapt. Now, if it's not that, then it just might be the way in which you communicate or present. Now, if English is a second language, that is, that adds a layer of difficulty. And the reason that it can happen, or a person might fail because of the presentation, is that the examiner can only grade you based on what you say out loud. And so you definitely have got to get things out. You need to speak it out and explain yourself. And that means that this test requires a completely different approach. What are the things that are good? One of the books that's a good start is Bored Stiff. It's a good start. It kind of talks about, I think it does a good job giving some ideas and sort of how to game the exam in terms of the way you talk. Yes, a good start, but I think it's just a little bit too simplistic. So plan on trying to be, plan at being a little bit more difficult and a little bit more detailed than what Bored Stiff has. So what I decided to do is I decided to make a top 10 list, things that I think are important. And of course I wound up coming up with one more thing at the last minute. So these are actually my top 11 things to do for your oral boards. So, number one, first and most important, I think, is to talk. You gotta talk more and prepare as if you're giving a talk to a large audience. If you were giving a big presentation or a speech, you would not spend a lot of time just reading and memorizing. You would spend some time speaking and practicing and making sure that you could articulate the information. So that's the way in which you have to do this test. It's completely different. And so this is a public speaking test, and you have to approach it that way. And I have a couple of tricks that I'll go into, or a couple of methods that I think that I can speak about that are helpful. Number two is making sure that your study time is efficient. Again, being in a fellowship, you really don't have an awful lot of time, and so whatever time you do have, you've got to make it efficient. And I think that the most important thing to do is really to be doing a lot of mock orals. I feel like I see it every year where people always tell me, "No, I'm not ready to do the mock orals, or I'm not doing that many. I've just been studying." And then they kind of get into it a little bit late, and I think that people need to do mock orals much earlier. The reason is that I think people maybe delay it because they're nervous about them, or they feel like they need to study more. You should probably do the opposite. At least, again, I think this is my opinion, but I think that a lot of people tend to agree with this. But you need to take the opportunity now to fail, and you have to embrace those failures. And when you fail or you fumble, you figure out what your gaps of knowledge. And then when you find those gaps of knowledge, that's what you go and study. So the way in which I would maybe start breaking up the study time would be 30% or more on mock exams. I mean, I think you need to get that number up as high as possible, but as many mock exams or practice exams as you can do. And I think you should try to do them with senior faculty or board examiners, or make a trip to your home institution. Yes, it's helpful to be able to do it with your colleagues, your fellow residents, but you're probably not gonna get that same kind of nervousness as when you do it with a faculty member. So that's what you need to do. Seek them out and do as many as you can. And it works over the phone too. I did a lot over the phone, and a phone is a great way to do it. So call up, try to make a habit of doing one every night. Call up your old faculty. So if we're going to do 30% mock exams, then the rest would be whatever time you have on your own. So 15% of the time focused on your weak areas. Now, your weak areas are the things that you discover through doing your mock orals. And then I would say you need about maybe 15 minutes or 15% of the time reviewing what you had just whatever you're studying. So you need to review. You need repetition, and you can't just do rote memorization of all this stuff, one time. So try to review a little bit every day, build that into your study session, and then 15% on new material, and then 15% on what I call spiels, which are kind of like rehearsed little segments. I'm going to get into that in a second. So when you're doing this stuff, you should be breaking this down and switching things around every single day. Again, I mentioned how important it is to practice talking. When you don't have the time or you're not able to do a mock oral, that doesn't mean that you can't speak out loud. So if you're in the car, I think you should try and do something creative with that time. And what you could do is you could practice speaking out loud, and you could do the same thing in the shower. I know it sounds crazy, but I did it. I know a lot of people that did it. And when you kind of get into this last couple months or a couple weeks, you kind of get a little bit more desperate, and you need to seek out whatever time you have. And so those might be the, times when you're home alone, in the shower, in the car. So, yes, you do need to have the medical knowledge. I think Michael Ho had talked about what he thinks is most important thing is that everyone just needs to have more medical knowledge. Yeah, that is important. Yeah, obviously you can't just take the test and not know have the knowledge. But as I mentioned, you already passed their written exam, and you have to be very careful about how you use your study time. So you have to get the information across, and I think for some people, they're going to be fine, and some people actually need to work on their public speaking skills. I know I did. I had to work hard. I would get nervous, and sometimes stuff would not come out. Okay, so my third thing is to make note cards. And I think everybody should try to do this. And if you're running out of time, maybe you could just think, listen to the idea, and try to do whatever you can with the time left. I had a very well-respected faculty member in my residency who told me, he told me to do this, and he said that everyone who he told do this had passed. So you try to shoot for around 100 note cards, and on the first 25 or 30, you're going to write down the top 25 or 30 common diseases. So that would be like diabetes, hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, obesity, all the do go as first start as generic as possible, and then work your way through more of the specific ones. And what you want to do is on the back of the note card, you're going to make three sections, and you're not going to do a lot of information because you want to be able to use these note cards to memorize and be able to speak this stuff out loud. But you wanna have three sections: the pre-op, intra-op, and post-op. Now, the pre-op stuff is basically like what are your preoperative concerns and what testing you might need to do. The intra-op stuff is what are you gonna be the things that you'll do and what kind of things will go wrong. And then same with as with the post-op. So what is this doing? This is basically it's doing two things. One is it's predicting the exam. So you can effectively predict what the exam will be. You know that it's going to be your a test on the anesthesia and coexisting diseases and how things go wrong. And you break it up into the intra-op, the pre-op, and the post-op. So the next thing would be to make like 20 or so note cards on the derangements of physiology. For example, hypoxemia or bradycardia. So on the front of the note card, you write hypoxemia. And then on the back, you write down two sections. Basically, the differential diagnosis or all the different causes of hypoxemia. And then the second thing would be what you actually do or how you work your way through a hypoxemic episode to try to treat it. And this is probably should be your number one, because if you don't get a question on hypoxemia in your anesthesia oral boards, then I don't know what to tell you, because it's one of the most common and most important aspects of what we do. So that's the second thing. Then I would make maybe a couple note cards on monitors, and this is just maybe on the more sophisticated monitors. I don't think people are really getting asked about PA catheters anymore. There's probably a few people that like to ask about PA catheters. If you want, you could do a note card on PA catheter, but you have to be careful because the examiner is probably going to know more about you. So you could write down one or two things that where you know exactly what you want to say. And then maybe a few note cards on your cho of your choice of some things that the board loves, with like for example PEEP and CPAP. I think it's helpful to just have the note card, and then have kind of the exact thing that you want to say. So again, the reason for doing this is one was to predict the exam, but the other was to actually do repetition. And so the adult brain needs this needs repetition, the way in which we study. So the way I had a surgeon attending in my residency, he would always tell me the same thing. The hallmark, or he would say, the repetition is the hallmark of adult education. So that's why I said, build a little tiny review into your daily study session. You have to review what you did the day before, and then you do the note cards so that you're reviewing, or excuse me, you look at your front of your note card and then you say it out loud, and you are effectively not only are you repeating and learning what you need to say, but then you're also speaking it aloud and you're practicing getting it, verbalizing it. Okay, the fourth thing is what I call the spiels, which I got from Niels Jensen. He's the big blue guy, and he did a thing. He made a CD thing called Ranger Red, which I wound up getting a hold of, and I listened to a few of the CDs. Some of them are pretty good. I think I actually have it. If anybody wanted to contact me, I can get you copies of it if you want to listen to it in your car. But one of the things that I thought that was really smart was a thing called spiels, which is basically a rehearsed explanation of something that you feel that is either common or something that you need to work on. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying with these note cards. So, like, for example, I love the example of PEEP, because PEEP is, I think it was, for a lot of people, it's difficult to explain PEEP, but everybody kind of knows when to use it and what it is. But the board would, if you ever mention it, they're going to ask you what it is. And, you may want to have be able to articulate a short answer. So here, what would I say on PEEP, for example? I'd say the major effect of PEEP on the lungs is to increase the FRC. And it's useful in patients with decreased lung volumes. PEEP increases the FRC in tidal ventilation above closing capacity. It improves lung compliance, and it corrects ventilation perfusion abnormalities. The principal mechanism of action of PEEP appears to be stabilization and expansion of partially collapsed alveoli. Now, I was just reading that, so if that sounded like I was reading it, well, I was. I wanted to make sure that it sounded good. But the one of the things in my answer that is kind of funny is that I said FRC, and I think the first thing that an examiner would do would they would interrupt you and say, "Oh, well, what's FRC?" And then you'd have to say, "Well, that's the lung volume at the end of normal exhalation, and this is the volume at which the inward elastic recoil of the lung approximates the outward elastic recoil of the chest." So, you know, onward it goes, and then they, you know, this is how it works with the examiners. You say one thing, and then they take you down a kind of a pathway of trying to explain more and more things. Anyway, moving on to number five. Number five is another strategy that I got from Niels Jensen, and I think it's important, and it kind of is a. It's the method in which you use that 5 minutes before the before you start your exam, and I think that it can be very intimidating and nerve-wracking, and you got a lot of data to look at, and I think that the goal there is to really confuse people, or maybe not so much confuse people, but they have to make it long, because otherwise, if there wasn't enough information there, it would just be too easy. And I think what they want you to do is they really want you to try to tease out the important stuff. And one of the things that you need to do within the first 2 minutes of that 5 minute time is to know how to do the induction of anesthesia. That's one of the most important things. It's not more important than everything else, but it's just a big part of it. And so you really want to know how you're going to just induce the patient. So you gotta have a method and how you're going to kind of scan through it. There's going to be a lot of different problems, and you're going to be managing conflicting goals. So quickly figure out how you're going to induce that patient. And then, of course, with the remaining time, you can kind of just spend it trying to anticipate what kind of things are going to go wrong. And then they will go wrong, guaranteed. Everything is going to go wrong in the test. Okay, number six is my little personal trick. I think I don't know where I got this actually, but I've been telling it to people every year, and they love it. So it's my water glass trick. And the reason that I bring this up is that some people say that they get, maybe you get flustered, or you get confused by a really bizarre question, or maybe you just need like a moment to just collect some thoughts, because you're just trying to shake off like a lot of really weird questions. So you get asked a question, you grab your water glass and you take a sip. You tell them, "Excuse me for one moment." You take a sip of water, and you know, it's basically, it's just a classy way of just taking a little time. Now, obviously if you do this every single time, what's going to happen is basically what happened to me is that you have to go to the bathroom really bad by the end of the second room. So you probably don't want to do it every single time. Another a version of this is basically you can ask them to clarify their question. You are allowed to ask questions. You don't want to turn the exam on them. But there's nothing wrong with saying something like this, like let's say they had there was a long and confusing question, and you can say, let me see if I understand you correctly. You're asking me X, Y, and Z." Something like that, I think, is totally appropriate. And I think that it can slow things down at a time where things might be confusing. So I think it can be valuable at certain times. Number seven is to write out the arterial blood gases. Now, they love to do this. They're going to give you the arterial blood gas in the most bizarre manner possible. They're not going to tell you pH, CO2, PaO2. They're going to tell you, they're first going to say partial pressure of carbon dioxide is 53. Then they'll say base deficit is minus 4. The partial pressure of oxygen is 60 or 65. And the pH will be like last or something. So what you need to do is get your pen and paper and write it down in the order that makes sense to you. Definitely do not just sit there and listen to it and think that you've got it, because I don't know, it's just something weird about the way that they say it. So it'll be much better if you write it out for yourself. And that's just you can write other things out too. Like when they say strange things, just grab your pen, especially for the grab bags when you start getting all this new information. Furthermore, on this particular issue, I'll just say you want to be prepared to draw things. They do this a lot. They'll ask you something and they'll say like, "Can you draw that?" So like flow volume loops or late decelerations. They love that kind of stuff, and they also would go so far as to actually have you stand up and act things out. It actually happened to me in my the very first. I think the very first minute of my very first exam, or maybe not the first minute, but whenever I got to the induction, I was talking about how I was going to do a rapid sequence with inline stabilization. And the examiner made me stand up and say, "Well, just show me where the your assistant is going to be and how you're going to stand." And he really took a long time, and I was getting rather irritated. So, you know, just keep that in the back of your mind that they might have you do these weird things, and you know, don't worry about it. It's just part of the test, and then you know, do the best you can, and then just move on. Number eight. This is something that I got from some of these senior examiners that I know really well. These are actual board examiners, and for some reason, it drove them crazy. When I would waffle or change my mind. Now, so what I'm saying here is don't waffle and don't change your mind unless you've obviously made a mistake. Now, when you've obviously made a mistake and they might catch you in it, it's okay to say, "You know what? I misspoke. I misspoke. The correct thing is to do the rapid sequence." But this, what I'm saying is that they may ask you something, for example, like, "What kind of ventilation are you going to do in the ICU?" And you could just, you know, you pick something. I'm going to just do pressure control ventilation. What they're going to do is they're going to say, "Well, isn't it better to do this?" And then you could, you know, and what they're trying to do is just say, "Well, yeah, that actually probably is better." And they'll say, "Well, what about this?" They just want to push you around and make you do whatever they want. So the goal for you, and what they want to see is they want you to pick an answer and defend it. Now, it's tough with these guys because they, you know, they generally know this stuff extremely well. So what you want to do is you want to do whatever you're used to doing at your home institution. So whatever you're comfortable with. So for example, if they were to say, you know, like, "What drug are you going to do?" And you say, I'm gonna use you know, propofol, and then they say, "Well, why not this drug?" Okay, the right way to defend it would be, say, "Okay, so that other drug is a good drug, and it has these other advantages, and it could be used, yes, but my choice is still drug A, and my reasons are X, Y, and Z." And even if you don't have, even if you can't think of a reason, just say, at the very least, you can say, "This is what I'm most familiar with. I have, I'm experienced with this. I know that that other drug is good. It could be used in the manner you're saying it, but my choice is still A." So anyway, so the thing there is to not, you know, not waffle around too much. Okay, now that leads me into number nine. I just said not to change your mind or waffle, but Number nine is to adapt. You have got to be extremely careful. This is how people fail, is to not adapt. So that's very different than defending your choice. Failure to adapt is like they're telling you that the situation is changing, and now you need to make a different plan. Examples are you don't get the IV that you wanted pre-op for your child with acid reflux, and now what are you gonna do? I have heard a story of a person failing where they say, oh, like, I always get an IV. I'm gonna get an IV. No, you're not gonna get an IV. That's the virtual reality of the situation, and they're not gonna give you the IV, so you need to adapt. So you gotta play along, and people do fail on this particular issue. I think most people will probably do well, but if you want to know one area that can really get people is to failing to adapt and even going so far as to argue with the examiner, which sounds crazy, but there are stories of it. Okay, number 10, and I got this out of the book called Bored Stiff. Make your patient healthy. And what I mean by that is make the assumption that the patient is healthy or as healthy as possible or has things. And you, in other words, don't start inventing things that you're worried about. So, how can I explain this? I'll give you an example. So if they, one of the things that might happen is, let's say that they didn't explain what you saw on an airway exam, and they say, well, how are you going to do your induction? And, you say, well, I'm going to just do this. I'll do a rapid sequence. And, some people might start saying, like, I don't know, crazy stuff. Like, they'll say, well, there are things that I need to worry about here. Like, for example, the patient could possibly have difficult airway, or they might have hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy. As soon as you start saying things that were not in the stem, well, then the examiner has like it's like open season, and then they start asking you on that stuff, which had absolutely nothing to do with the flow of your test. So I know that it sounds. I guess it sounds kind of simple and maybe a little bit weird the way I explained it, but unless otherwise instructed, you just consider that those things are not there and that they're healthy. So so unless it's otherwise written or they, 'cause they'll stop you if you have failed to see something, and you say I'm going to go ahead and just do this rapid sequence, and then they say, well, wait a second, aren't you worried about the airway? You can just stop, pause. Oh, I see Mallampati 3. Then you can say, you know what? Assuming that the rest of my exam was good, the thyromental distance, this and that and the other, I feel comfortable proceeding with the laryngoscopy. And that works great. Like, they love it when you go ahead and do the put the patient to sleep and do the laryngoscopy. I think that they get a little annoyed when everybody jumps immediately to the awake fiber optic. Now, you do the awake fiber optic when it's reasonable, but what a lot of times there'll be this gray area, and there's a gray area, and they kind of want to see what you do. And it's not wrong to say you do awake fiber optic when it's a gray zone, but I think that they get secretly pleased when you don't immediately jump to like the safest, craziest thing. Anyway, probably a little bit too much info on that, but so the point is, don't assume that there's like all these other things there. Make the patient healthy. Okay, and the last and final thing is myasthenia gravis. I just want to say myasthenia gravis, if you don't know myasthenia gravis really well, it's going to be very painful if you get a full stem and the patient has myasthenia gravis. The board loves myasthenia. They just absolutely love it. And you got to know it. It's a little bit obscure. It's not obscure. it's like we don't see it every day, and so that in that sense, it's like it's less common. But the board loves it. So I would just say you make sure that you put myasthenia gravis, in your top very important things to do. And you could probably put in the myasthenic syndrome in there as well. So that's it. So that's my top 11 things on the oral boards. I hope that this was helpful. And let me know. Give me some feedback, good or bad. And I'm around for mock orals and questions, and possibly looking to maybe do some more pediatric anesthesia podcasts, more things that might be useful for the fellowship. All right. So I just had a chance to go back and listen to what I just recorded, and it was kind of funny because I noticed a lot of ums and ahs and a little bit of a broken speech, and it's kind of funny how this there was a lot of advice on public speaking, so I'm gonna have to actually work on that if I'm gonna do more podcasts anyway. And one other thing I thought I would mention is when I was listening to the little component where I said to do mock orals over the phone, I was reminded of a funny story how I was doing when I was living in New Zealand. I was doing mock orals for friends of mine over the phone from New Zealand, and it worked actually kind of well. Skype and FaceTime work well too, so that's just one other thing I wanted to add in. So anyway, thanks again for listening, and good luck.